Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. The first thing I'd like to do is to introduce my co-author, who's sitting at the back there, and is going to run away at 1:15 when the question starts. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to use the mic because, as you might be able to tell, my voice is a little weak today. So that's why I'm not going to sit in your midst. I'm going to stand here, if you don't mind. What I'm going to present is some data using mainly published information on the FTSE 100 concerning intra-firm inequality. And the published data allow us to look at the relationship between chief executive pay and average pay within a number of firms. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and I'm going to talk a little bit about sources of variation as well, because actually the ratios are quite variable, and the processes that underlie the variability, I think, are quite interesting. One of the things about management academics is we tend to take the firm as the unit of analysis, and this is probably very familiar to all of you. One of the things I'm interested in is the extent to which increases in inequality within firms contribute to overall increases in pay inequality. You find quite a number of economists arguing that it's inter-firm differences that matter a lot, but at least the work that people like John Van Reenen have done for the UK don't include stock option data, and we do. So part of the argument today is that executive compensation matters a lot to these increased multiples, and we use that published data from the FTSE to talk about it. Of course, if a large number of people, of employees in a given economy, do work in large firms, then the impact of large firm policies on aggregate inequality data are likely to be significant, and that is true still for the UK, that we do have a fairly large proportion of our workforce to work in firms, larger firms, in which there's very likely to be some kind of stock option system in place for senior management and the CEO in particular. We know that the total earnings of senior executives in the FTSE 350 and the FTSE 100 have gone up quite rapidly. When you look at these curves, you see that it's the FTSE 100 lead executives who've done best in the period since the turn of the century. But you wouldn't necessarily understand just from these curves that there was a financial crash in the middle of all of this. And so these trends have proved quite resilient. And in fact, for the FTSE 100 lead executives, quite advantageous, because the curve is steeper after the crash. One of my themes today is that to the extent that we have a group of employees, senior executives, whose pay is linked to capital market measures, and a large number of employees whose pay is in effect linked to movements in either the National Living Wage or the RPI, it's a recipe, it's a perfect storm for increasing inter-firm inequality. And we've had that kind of set of arrangements in place now, more or less since the crash. These are just descriptive data indicating in a little more detail what's going on. You see that average national earnings doesn't tend to, in this period, go massively ahead of the RPI, but the FTSE numbers do, and in the bottom two bullets you can see that chief executive pay goes up quite a lot in this period, and as a result the average ratio in the FTSE goes up from 56-1 to 171 to 1. And just to repeat, I'm using the ratio of CEO pay to average pay, recognizing that the underlying ketosis, skewness in the distributions across firms might be highly variable, but this is what you can do with published data in the UK. In the United States, there's an attempt to get firms to publish median pay, and the SEC is wrestling with a formula for that right now. But clearly, for the firm, calculating median pay is much more onerous than simply publishing the number of employees and the total wage bill. And that's where I am today, because politically, I think there's much more interest in these ratios now than there was a few years ago. I think people are still talking in terms of publishing those kinds of data. So my theme today is that you can relate some of these changes to changes in the processes for setting pay within firms. In terms of the increase in the ratio of very highly paid to low paid employees within firms, economists might have explanations that rest more heavily on returns to skill premia and the increasing scarcity of certain types of skills. My focus today is going to be much more on what do firms do in order to set pay. And I'm going to introduce two ideas. One is the idea of administered inequality, and the other is an idea of outsourced inequality, which I'll explain. I think, in brief, firms used to think about legitimizing inequality in terms of the overall pay structure within the firm. And what happens now is that there are a group of employees who have achieved escape velocity from those kinds of considerations and had their pay anchored to capital market measures, which creates much of the observed difference. So I'm going to try and link that to changes in the structure of the firm. We in the management field use an expression of managerial capitalism, which many of you may be familiar with and is related to the work of Alfred Chandler, business strategy academic. This is the idea that for large periods of time in the middle of the 20th century, firms were pretty independent of governments and of capital markets. And that in this period, managers had a great deal of autonomy both to run their businesses and to set pay. Paradoxically, this is also a period in which the kinds of measures I'm talking about are much lower than they are today. And I'm going to argue that the decay of managerial capitalism into a set of arrangements dominated by shareholder value considerations have uncoupled very senior management pay from other mechanisms for pay setting within the firm, and that the key issue here is capital market oversight of firm activities. So the key issue here is the introduction and advocacy of a set of pay arrangements which attempt to solve agency problems by linking chief executive pay to performance in the stock price or some derivative or arrangement related to that. So my theme is that as the firm seeks to to consider its pay structure as a single entity, we enter much broader or much bigger multiples than we used to. So let me talk, if I may, just a little bit about the idea of administered inequality and what it meant for higher pay within firms. So by administered inequality, I'm talking about a set of arrangements where the bulk of employees within the firm are covered by one or more internal labor market arrangements. So the typical basis for setting pay in these kinds of organizations would be for managerial and more senior grades would be to use job evaluation techniques. These are input-based measures of the difficulty or skill involved in a job. And they became, in ways that I hope to show in a few minutes, really quite prevalent in the post-war period. My first job was working in a labor union in the banking sector, manipulating job evaluation schemes to get pay rises, which got around incomes policy. I'm not meaning to suggest these are anything other than legitimation devices, but they were pretty influential legitimation devices. So I'm going to argue that the other element in administered inequality is collective bargaining, which, as you know, used to be much more prevalent in the private sector in the UK than it is now. In fact, you can speak since the early 80s of the collapse in coverage of collective bargaining in the private sector. And what that does, I think, is to raise a couple of issues. One is, if collective bargaining collapses, then what is the mechanism that is used to set the pay for people towards the bottom end of the pyramid in the organization? But it goes a bit further than that. There's pretty good data, which we discuss in the paper, I haven't got time really to go into much today, to show more for the US than the UK that companies that do have collective bargaining have senior management pay, which is towards the low end of the spectrum, and partly because the stock option elements are lower and the salary elements are higher. So my point is that administered inequality represented a reliance on a set of organizational processes which were to a greater or lesser degree integrated, but which treated the span of pay differences within the organization as being subject to internal management decision. And I'm contrasting that with the period since roughly the mid-80s, when we see a massive growth, well documented in Sandy's work, in payments to executives through stock options and long-term incentive plans. Primarily using measures and incentives based on movements in stock prices or futures in stock prices. Now, there's another sense in which I want to use the term outsourced, because shareholder value conceptions about the structure of firms have led to a great deal of outsourcing of lower paid work, which incidentally might be part of the explanation for why inter-firm differences are good explainers of lots of inequality. And I'm going to talk a bit more about this, but using data from, amongst others, the CBI, what we're finding is that where collective bargaining collapses in a firm, then the pay-setting mechanisms tend to rely to some extent on movements in the national minimum wage or the national living wage. Now, I do not mean by that the pay is set at those levels. I mean, if the NLW goes up by 4%, then pay goes up by 4%. It's used as a benchmarking index in the absence of collectively bargained agreements. So the upshot of this is that within outsourced inequality, somebody's living in capital markets and somebody's living in labor markets. And as I say, in the period since 2008, given movements in the retail price index and the wage indices and movements in the capital markets, this is a perfect storm for generating massive increases in intra-firm multiples. It really is. So what does a disadministered inequality look like in the past and at the top in a little more detail? I'm looking around the room and wondering how many people are old enough to remember this, but there used to be, particularly in nationalized industries, top salary review bodies, which worked in various ways, not all of them wonderful, but they were mechanisms by which some public justification was given for the setting of top salaries, as opposed simply to a formula that could go off like a bomb as your stock price goes up and generate massive increases in income. And from the 1980s, job evaluation schemes like that sold proprietarily by a company called Hay Management Consultants grew to be very influential in two senses. One, they covered lots of firms. And second, they covered lots of layers of management within firms. So they went really quite high, particularly in the banking sector. I don't want to give a lecture on job evaluation because this would empty the room faster than anything else I can think of. But essentially what the Hay system does is it assigns a number of points to a job. So the points give the worth of the job. And the points all have the same value. So as it puts a cap on the differentials that can emerge towards the top end of a distribution. Now we know from certain data, not wonderful, that the ratio of CEO to starting graduate pay was about 20 to 1 in the 1980s. So there's good grounds for thinking that this system was associated with much lower multiples than we're seeing now. And then we begin to see the nature of the consultants involved change, and Towers Perrin, another US consultancy, come into the United Kingdom, and remuneration consultancy becomes the thing to be in if you're an HR specialist, because you walk around designing packages which are based not on input measures, like a Hay point, but on measures of the performance of the stock of the business. That's a fundamental change. With privatization under Thatcher governments, this spread to companies which had previously been covered by top salary review bodies. And in the Greenbury report in 1995, we get a reasonably early legitimation of the distinction between executive and managerial pay. And I would say, from my own experience dealing with companies, this is a fault line that runs through companies, not between those at the very top and those at the very bottom of the pay hierarchy, but within the managerial structure, between those who have their remuneration anchored to company performance measures and those who are on salary. And it can lead to enormous differentials in pay, even within managerial hierarchies. Now, this is the slide that I wish I'd blown up to 5 times its current size, so I'm going to have to talk about it a little more because you won't be able to read it. I had a PhD student a few years ago who looked at variance in these matters. So she looked at the relationship between CEO pay and average employee pay just before the crash, which is why I've shown you these data. And fortunately, the main point I want to make about the slide is visible, which is that the lines are of different heights. So these are, what you can't read, these are sectors. She's broken down the multiples by SIC categories. And some towards the right, as you look at it, are even in 2008 well above 200. And others are much, much lower. So my point is that when you look at the FTSE listed companies, you do find enormous variance in these ratios. And that's what I'd like to turn attention to right now. Over on the right, as you look at it, the high side, it's not financial institutions. They actually have quite low multiples because they don't have a lot of low-paid employees. What you've got over on the right-hand side are companies in areas like food retailing, where those at the top of the organization participate in the feast, which is executive remuneration, and those at the bottom of the organization whose work is not outsourced and so disappears from the record here, it's Tesco's, it's Sainsbury's, it's people stacking shelves on very low pay. That's the kind of company in which you get a huge multiple. So two things, the introduction of executive compensation and the failure, inability, unwillingness to outsource low-paid work is what gets you a big multiple. For example, multiples, some of the lowest multiples I'll show you are of financial services firms. And in a financial service firm, if you go and visit Goldman Sachs down on Fleet Street, it's an awfully long time before you meet a Goldman Sachs employee. It's definitely the other side of the swipe, because everybody you meet as you go in is not on their books. And everybody in the catering is not on their books. So their multiples are quite low. It's where everybody in the organization is in the published data that we get these kinds of huge multiples. So let me bring us a little further up to date. Here we have the averages for the FTSE 100, so the top 100 companies on the FTSE, very few of which, as you know, are UK companies anymore. And so there's quite a large standard deviation in CEO compensation, but 5.6 million is about the going rate. But here's the variance. 70 million is the top. It's Martin Sorrell at WPP. This is Mr. Englehart, who runs Admiral Insurance, who retains a very high, proportion of ownership of the company. So it doesn't bother to take much in his remuneration package because it's off the record. But it's a huge range. And I haven't got time today to go through all of the factors that would influence this range. But American-owned companies tend to be a bit higher. Companies where the CEO has been around for a long time and is in a very dominant position, epitomized by Sorrell, tend to be higher. And those who are newly incoming CEOs tend to be lower. I think at least as interesting is the average earnings figure of FTSE 100 companies. In the end of 2015, the average incomes in the UK was much lower than this. Now, this figure does contain some social security costs, like national insurance. But what struck both of us is how high average earnings are in FTSE 100 companies. I can't make too much comment on the shape of the distributions, but I think it's consistent with the argument that many of them do outsource a lot of low-paid work. And that there's a huge range. 313,000 as an average is 3i, I'm pretty sure. The financial services company. so you can, it's quite important in evaluating the multiple to have some understanding of the boundaries of the business and the structure of it. And that's a particularly innovative thing to say. We all know that income inequality within Nike is a tiny fraction of income inequality within the Nike supply chain. But in a small way, those considerations are relevant to the UK FTSE as well. I thought you might be interested just to look at some companies. These are the two highest multiples at the end of 2015 on the FTSE. Shire is a biopharma company, WPP we've talked about. This is Reckitt Benckiser. And then quite a number of the financial services institutions have lower multiples, below 50. And my point is, if these multiples become, as I think they are, a matter of political and public interest, then evaluating them needs to take some consideration of what is under the data in some respects, because the prospects for gaming here are really quite substantial. If my shareholders at an annual meeting tell me that the multiple is too high, the best thing I can do is outsource all the low pay or take the highest paid executive off the board. So these things don't need to be published in quite the way that they might. So I want to come back to that because, and I think one, to the extent that it was that a high ratio is seen to be in some senses a negative thing, either because there are too many low-paid or a few high-paid people in an organization, the company's ability to manipulate those data needs to be taken into account. So here's the contrast I made very briefly earlier. And I wanted to use it just to show you how much, you know, both the numerator and the denominator matter in these kinds of things. I should have said this, the second column is Barclays. There's a typo on that slide. I apologize. But you can see there's not a huge difference in CEO comp. I haven't looked under the Barclays figure, but I'm sure the fact that they've been the most fined company in financial services has something to do with the kinds of data that they want to publish about their CEO pay. And I can't believe Bob Diamond went home with only $3.6 million in his pocket. But nonetheless, the key thing, of course, is that Tesco does have really quite a large number of people on or near national living wage, and so their average is low, so their multiple is low. And Barclays has quite a bit of outsourcing in areas where pay tends not to be high. Whether you could argue that the chief executive of Tesco is operating in the same kind of international market for chief executives as the CEO of Barclays is a consideration we might want to talk about later on, but that's the justification for these kinds of figures. So Barclays has a ratio of not quite a tenth of Tesco. So this is what it looks like for the FTSE 100 as a whole in terms of employee CEO to employee average pay ratios for 2015. The majority, are between 0 and 100. Well, they're nowhere near 0, sorry, but they're under 100. And then there are very few, and we've talked about a couple of them, that are over 500. To summarize, there are sectoral patterns of variance, but a lot of other heterogeneity within sectors as well. In order to understand why a multiple hits a particular number, you would have to have data not just about CEO compensation, but also about the structure of the supply chain that the business sat in to understand things like outsourcing. So if I spent a bit of time looking at the top end of this outsourced inequality issue, we're looking at, outsourcing in the sense that these packages tend to be set by remuneration committees, which consist of other CEOs. They don't tend to be set without reference to what's going on in other companies in other sectors. Let me turn to the other end of the distribution, which is the lower paid end. The low pay unit and the CBI have both been trying to assess what they call the bite of changes to the national living wage. And the CBI in particular is fairly strongly of the view that for many of their members, the movement in, not the level, but the movement in these measures sets the tone for pay setting within their organization. So if it moves by 4%, they'll put a 4% on their wage bill. The low pay units found that this tends to have a kind of compressing effect on differentials at the lower end of the pay distribution. But over the period 2011 to 16, we're seeing private sector pay settlements and average weekly earning growth at levels much, much lower than movements in pay of those based on capital market measures, approximately a tenth. I was talking to somebody from the CBI just the other day who's was checking this out in a rather different way. He's finding that large numbers of companies within the CBI are actually moving their pay setting date to October because that aligns with the movement in these indices, which is... he's also very happy because, I don't know if you know, but membership applications to the CBI are going up and up and up. I wonder why. Ever since the Brexit vote. Sorry, that's great. It's 2% per year.
And the 20%
is also
per year.
Sandy? That's the FTSE index overall. Over the period, yes, sorry.
So that's more like 2% versus about
3%. Yeah, sorry, yeah, I misspoke. You're right.
So it's slightly higher than normal.
Yeah. But the movements in executive comp that I showed you on the earlier slide are moving faster than it. So... The point I make here is that since the crash and the introduction of the national living wage, reliance on CPI plus for low pay, represented by increases in the NLW, causes compression at the lower end of the firm distribution, and reliance on capital market measures for executive pay causes really quite big moves at the top. And that's why you see the multiples are moving even faster now. So it goes back to my earlier point about the absence of something to anchor CEO pay at the top into the firm's hierarchy of pay and the absence of collective bargaining to compress pay overall at the bottom means that these two processes are decoupled. But there are huge sectoral differences in the inter-firm distributions based on outsourcing and on what I mean by denominator effects is how many low-paid workers are actually in the published data for FTSE firms. So let me, conscious of time, let me just summarize. The argument that we present in the paper is that the processes do matter and that they're uncoupled, that pay setting at the top and the bottom are uncoupled in such a way as to influence the extent of intra-firm inequality. I tried to indicate the decline of administrative inequality and the rise of outsourced and make the point that when firms push reliance on external factors into their pay setting processes, these are different external factors. On the one hand, they are capital market measures for executive pay, and on the other, they are either NMW, RPI, or CPI measures for low pay. I've tried to make the point that in explaining variance in the multiples of intra-firm inequality, outsourcing is quite important. If firms do get rid of from their published data of large numbers of low-paid employees by subcontracting activities, that has a big impact. And the final point I wanted to mention again was I think the prospects for gaming here are really quite substantial if firms are held to account. So if it does become an issue about access to government contracts, if you have multiples that are too high, or your shareholders getting angry at meetings, then there are a variety of mechanisms available to companies to reduce the extent of intra-firm inequality visible from published data. And I'll stop there, if I may. And Sandy is happy to answer any difficult questions you have.
Yeah, so we have, we'll take the first question at the back and then come, and we'll work our way down the table. Great.
All right, perhaps I have two questions. The first one first. At the very bottom, this question may have to do with that, and you may want to just not answer the question. When you have the evaluation of executive pay in capital markets, are we comparing performance or profitability, or what is the basis of the data, and is it the same across the companies that we're looking at?
Let's see if I've got the question, but judge from my answer. The data we're using here are data that companies are required to publish if they're listed, in fact, if they're PLCs, I think.
Yeah.
And they reflect, the top end, they refer to the total compensation package of the chief executive. That's what I've focused on here. What I haven't presented is any data on firm performance.
Yeah.
And I haven't presented any data that suggests that highly rewarded chief executives, comparatively highly rewarded chief executives, are always in companies with better performance. In fact, there's some quite good data to show that there isn't a very good relationship between the size
right.
of the CEO's package and firm performance. So I haven't touched on firm performance today. I'd be more concerned to look at the processes that affect a particular dependent variable, which is the multiple.
Okay, I understand that.
Okay.
That could be a big source of inequality. That could be a big source of inequality if one doesn't look at what those packages actually represent, what they're made of.
Well, the packages are made of different levels of salary,
options
on stock. Yeah, and those bundles would be, to a limited degree, variable company by company. But the structure of the packages, again, is something we're looking at rather separately. We can only work with the published data, and they're valued in a particular way, which is a standard way.
The key point is that the fixed pay of chief executives has not increased anything like the rate of token pay. The fixed pay of chief executives has increased much the same sort of levels as have been.
The inflation comes from the capital based rewards, which are linked to capital market. Okay. And the second question was, you mentioned Goldman Sachs, and I didn't quite follow that. You have the level of the executive pay, and then you mentioned the other people that just came through the door, and that data was not accounted.
Yeah, so yeah, in any company where the outsourcing takes place of lower pay, those pay figures don't appear on the company reporting. Yeah, so if we if you use Compass for your work canteen and G4S for your security, The pay data of those people does not appear in the data published for the outsourcing company.
Right. Then I'm wondering if one's comparing apples and pears, because some companies will be outsourcing to a greater or lesser degree, and some maybe not at all.
And that is precisely our point. Okay. That in evaluating these multiples, you need some knowledge of this taking place. Goldman Sachs wasn't a great example because it's not listed, but I was trying to make the point that let me put it a slightly different way. I think it would be a very brave business decision for Tesco to outsource all of their store staff. You know, some days it feels like they have, but I think it would be a very brave decision to do that. So they're constrained by the structure of their business to have a particular occupational structure internal to the firm. Whereas many companies do have the choice. I mean, LSE, as you know, has now chosen to have our cleaning staff employed by LSE as opposed to outsource. And that's going to, in ways I can't predict, affect our multiple in some ways, you know. My gaming point was simply that if you outsource more at the bottom end, you'll affect the structure of the earnings distribution and probably the multiple as well. Yeah. One final point to make. And I think one of the reasons why I focus on intra-firm inequality. One of the reasons why inter-firm explanations are powerful is that there are companies like G4S with very, very large numbers of low-paid individuals working in them because of this outsourcing, precisely because this outsourcing is taking place.
So,
I think you tell a very compelling story about the effect of structuring remuneration in this way with a higher proportion of stock options, the effect of that on inequality. But I think it's also interesting to ask why it is that firms have structured their remuneration packages in that way. And I understood you at the start to be maybe gesturing towards one explanation, which is on the along the lines of changes in shareholder value. I wondered if I could suggest two possible other explanations that actually operate on different sides of the transaction. So the first is the idea, and this is discussed in the US context, I think in a book called Winner Take All Politics, Catherine Pearson, about the idea that if you structure your remuneration in terms of options, that enables you to keep it off your accounts at the point at which you grant the option. Mm-hmm. And then that was attractive to on the company side. Something more specific to the UK that would make it attractive to structure your remuneration in that way from the employee's perspective may be the tax implications of doing it that way. In particular, there's a change, quite an important change, through the period that you're looking at, where under Nigel Lawson as Chancellor, there was actually a relatively sensible policy, I think, of taxing capital gains at the marginal income tax rate, which meant it didn't really matter from a tax point of view whether it was options income.
That's right.
But that was changed by Gordon Brown such that it became massively advantageous from a tax point of view, potentially, to take your income through stocks which might enable it. I'm not quite sure how these are structured exactly, but potentially to just pay the much lower capital gains tax rate rather than your marginal income tax rate. And so it looks like on both sides of the transaction there are incentives for them to structure the deal in this way.
I think both of these are very good points. So there's some nice work by a colleague in Columbia Business School, Bruce Kogut, to show that if you're looking to have an account of the explosion of these forms of executive compensation, you need to factor in the success of Silicon Valley, because the argument that you're not giving anybody money, just an option on future profits, and it doesn't show up much on the books, is great for a startup. In fact, it's about the only way that you can think of to do it. And Bruce's argument is that once you've started doing it in Silicon Valley, then everybody wanted a piece of the action. Yeah. But I mean, there's a strong ideological influence here. I mean, the work of economists like Michael Jensen suggesting you solve agency problems if you reward CEOs on stock is also a powerful influence here. And it's a shame Sandy's gone, because he has a rather eloquent story about the difficulty that it would be experienced by a large company going to its investors and saying, we're not going to provide incentives for our CEO. You know, it would be like it would be like Jose Mourinho saying, I'm going to pay my first team national minimum wage. You know, you wouldn't get away with it. You just wouldn't get away with it. Now, the tax story is not simply important in the UK, it's important in the US. And in the US, the big trigger is the Reagan tax reforms in the early 80s, which brought down the highest rate of income tax. There were stock options before that, but they were much smaller. And the other side of that story is what you see in many large American corporates is the introduction of these executive comp schemes, but the disappearance of the corporate jet and the golf club membership and all the other benefits you could give to senior managers that didn't show up for the IRS. So the tax story is very important. Yes, indeed.
This gentleman and then yourself.
Yeah. I just wondered whether you want or unable to extrapolate your kind of data to the question of why the top 0.1% is going up so sharply. Do you think this is a key part of that story? Do you think there are other important reasons why, when you look at the distribution, it's a tiny, tiny fraction at the top, even the 1% or even the 0.1%, which has risen so sharply post-2000?
Well, I could not put a number on it, but I think it is a significant issue, particularly in the United States, where you know the use of stock options is not just the absolute apex of the business, but it's the whole senior management team, and getting vested is a big deal. But you know, it's the old story. If you reward some people with pay and other people with what are in effect assets, don't be surprised if inequality increases. And I think I don't think firms in the UK, at least, consciously think about that. I think they used to think rather more about the relationship between top and bottom pay, because processes like job evaluation made them think about it. But now it seems as natural as anything to offer, to some firms, to offer the NLW increase to low pay and to set up, you know, these huge possible gains for senior executives, because they don't cost you as you've got to cost them using an options method, but they don't cost in quite the same way. And if performance doesn't happen, you don't pay, allegedly. You know. Except you do.
This seems to be a classic example of be careful what you wish for, because lots of people thought that publishing these ratios would reduce inequality, and it seems like not only are the numbers fundamentally meaningless, but that actually they could have a very bad effect of encouraging yet more outsourcing. So I wonder whether you've thought about other ratios that would be more effective, and one of the ones that I've heard about is the ratio between the CEO and not his direct reports or her direct reports, but the next level down.
Yes, indeed.
On the basis that, first of all, it's too big a group to gain, and secondly, that it shows that you've got a pipeline for the succession. So if you've got a CEO who's paid 10 times the level of his next report, then you haven't got a pipeline for the succession. If you've got a more equal structure at the top, then you're growing the next generation.
Okay, I'm going to begin by not taking issue with the word meaningless, but the word fundamentally. I do think there are some things you can tell from these data, and they're the only ones we've got publicly at the moment. But they do have to be taken, not with a pinch of salt, but with a pinch of understanding about what the other organizational arrangements are, particularly organizational boundaries. There's been some work done in the States to try and make these figures for the Apple supply chain, the Nike supply chain, so on and so forth. There are companies, large companies in the States, for example, like Uber, for which you simply, it wouldn't be meaningful in any way at all to try and do this. To your second point, I think there are much better measures that one could pick up if one had the richness of data from a number of companies. We're certainly looking into that. I, I, I would have to say that for US companies, the idea that the CEO would be only getting 10 times as much as her next but one direct report is...
No, I was talking about the next report.
Yeah, but sometimes the multiple from CEO to first report is over 100. And that's because of another approach, which is quite influential, which is known as tournament theory. So tournament theory impacts on remuneration package decisions. And the argument is you want a big incentive to give to the animal who wants to be CEO. And the bigger, the better, because the bigger gives you more of a fight and the winner likes it more. So I think you're right, but the multiples are bigger than you'd think.
Yeah.
Paul and then here. Yeah.
Thanks. I'd like to press you a bit more on this idea that CEO pay is rising because of capital markets rising.
Okay.
So, I mean, just sort of my earlier question, it seems like the FTSE only rose 3% a year, while you said that CEO's compensation was rising faster than that. Also, you mentioned before that for individual companies, there seems to be very little connection. And you mentioned in the aside, you know, you get performance for pay, and when it doesn't perform, you don't pay, in theory, in trouble, right?
Yeah.
And of course, they get paid even when they don't pay. And so it seems like, it seems hard to make the argument that an individual CEO's pay is really linked in a strong, systematic way over time to share prices. Also, you showed that they didn't dip when share prices dipped in the actual.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So the other story is, I mean, there's a whole range of other kinds of stories you could talk about, but it's just that, so clearly it's something to do with reaping capital income, right? So clearly it's something to do with the fact that they have more direct control over capital. So it's like a principal agent type problem, so the principal, the shareholders, know that the CEO, you know, has them by the delicate parts, right? So they have to be money and leeway, and, you know, that they need to treat them very nicely in some respect. Yeah. But then the kind of sociological type story that I've heard in the past is just that just through kind of changing attitudes and cultures and norms, they just manage to extract a bit more every year and a bit more every year through using these consultants. And so basically it's kind of a bargaining story, which is there's no change in productivity, there's no change in economic relationship, it's just that they've got better at bargaining more and more and more every year.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is truth in that, and there's... remember, they don't just reward them on movements in the indices. They give them chunks of stock, which, you know, can...
Not necessarily changes in the stock.
Yeah, not just changes on the stock. They give them chunks of stock in some cases. And there are some length of service-related elements in some of these packages as well. The performance issue, as I say, is one I haven't touched on today, but I think that picking up on your point, the idea that that a CEO's pay would move only with the performance of his or her own business is only part of the story, because, of course, there's movement of CEOs between businesses where they hike up. There's been a few very significant ones in the past few months where massive increases in an individual's pay have been generated simply by switching jobs. So there are a number of ingredients in there. On the mechanics of what these packages look like, it's unfortunately Sandy has left because he's the expert on it. But I mean, he would make the point that it's a little like an arms race, that, you know, shareholders are sort of trying to find out ways of tying these things more closely into some measures of performance. But since the CEO is the one who can manipulate the performance measures best in the first place, then the things like the timing of your strike price for the option and so forth, these things are highly manipulable. For the United States, forgive me the slightly longer stuff, for the United States, there's lots and lots of work on overlaps on remuneration committees, which indicates that it's not bargaining so much as reciprocity.
Sure.
Yeah, but I take your point that there really are strong social processes embedded in this pay setting process.
Yeah.
Thanks, Paul. That was really, really great. And thanks to Sandy, absent it. Can I put a guardedly optimistic, slightly more positive thought about the risks of gaming? Because as you as you kind of implied, outsourcing has actually already gone quite a long way for a lot of these organizations. Yeah. And as you said, it would be quite odd if the floor staff at Tesco suddenly became, well, all on 0 hours, for example, or all outsourced.
I think the form was more likely than
that. Yeah. So, but I think from a management point of view, from a sort of quality control point of view, and also from a general administrative and PR point of view, quite radical outsourcing would be a difficult story to tell, perhaps, to at least to thoughtful investors. There are other investors who might not care at all, but there are other investors who, similarly with trying to hide the CEO pay package in some way, it would immediately provoke the question, well, why are you actually doing that?
For sure.
The UK government now is going to require companies to publish the ratios exactly along the lines that you are using them. We're going to have this culture of scrutiny, I think. But we are, this system does rely on enough institutional investors bothering and caring. Because if they are passive and if they're all going to be index trackers or algorithmic, then actually, as you say, the possibility for gain perhaps would increase. So we do sort of need that human factor to stay engaged. So I just want to be hopeful that there might not be quite as much gain as you imply. Outsourcing, the other story of outsourcing in the past 20-odd years, of course, is that it's much harder work than management thought it was. So
yes, indeed.
It has to be managed. It's not a soft option. Yeah. And things, bad things can happen if you outsource badly. So I just want to be slightly more hopeful.
Yeah, I think the cognitive bias of mine that underlies this is that I always feel that the regulated run faster than the regulator. And, you know, you could just think, if it really mattered, it wouldn't be just a question of, you know, not being able to do this or not being able to do that. You'd find something else to do. Yeah. You know, companies within companies, shells.
Well, indeed, the financial sector, of course, we don't know about the really highly paid employees because they're not the highest paid director. They're just traders. Dealers,
traders, exactly.
Fantastic at making loads of money. Yeah. We've got no idea
there. And so just to run with this for a second, and at the end of the day, the US situation shows us that, you know, if you don't like being regulated as a limited company, as a PLC, because it discloses your earnings, you simply delist or you get involved in private. I mean, you take yourself off the public record by adopting another organizational form, and then it's extremely hard to know who's earning what.
You maybe have time for one more question if anyone had. Okay.
Yes.
One of the key dates that was not on your list is the date at which we required companies to publish the information of the executive board. I believe that happened in the late 90s, 2000 area, and I just wondered how much you thought that that's contributed to execs being able to have the information to bargain and say, well, so-and-so is earning this much. And it goes to show the perverse effects of...
Well, I don't think it mattered very much for two reasons. First of all, in our conversation, you know, they know. It doesn't need to be published. They know. Secondly, companies, Towers Perrin is one I would pick out, actually generate databases of executive comp that they will sell you. You know, so you go to them and you say, what should I pay Paul Willman because he's, I want him to do this, this, and they come back with numbers. My point is the remuneration consultants are very good at putting this information around and billing you for it. So, so I don't think that was particularly important, but I do. The comments were made about increased public scrutiny, with which I fully agree. I think it is going to be subject to increased scrutiny, and I think in not only in the UK but in the US as well, which I find slightly more surprising. And it seemed to be more relaxed about huge inequality over there. But the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, is concerned enough about this to try and provide detailed regulations on what companies should publish.
Thank you. Thank you to questions and to Paul. Can you join me again?
Thank you very much.